Hello, welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author Laura Foster. Laura is the author of several Portland and Greater Oregon guidebooks, including Lake Oswego, Images of America, the Portland Stairs book, Walks, Views, Stories, Walk There, 50 Treks in and Around Portland and Vancouver, Portland City Walks, 20 Explorations in and Around Town, and Portland Hill Walks, 24 Explorations in Parks and Neighborhoods. Her newest books, Columbia Gorge Getaways, 12 Weekend Adventures from Towns to Trails, and Walking with Ramona, Exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland, just came out. Laura Foster, welcome to Between the Covers.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Today we're talking about your newest book, Walking with Ramona, Exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland. Could you describe the book for our listeners?
Yes, the book came about because I had been asked about 8 years ago to lead walking tours for the Multnomah County Library of Beverly Cleary's life and the lives of her characters. So I created this tour and then was asked repeatedly over the years to give it over and over again. And so decided this year when OPB asked if I would be interested in leading them on the tour for their special on Beverly, I decided it would be a good time to just put it all down in a book. But the book is a lot more than just the walking tour. The tour is just one of the five chapters. There's a pretty in-depth look at what Portland of the 1920s was like, the years when Beverly was a young girl growing into a teenager. And so I take you into, as you're walking along, I show you things that she would have seen, like the sidewalk or the horse rings. I talk about how when she was a girl, Portland was a streetcar town, and so people didn't have garages. And so as you're walking through Hollywood now, of course, everybody has garages, and how those garages were carved into the front underneath houses or placed in front of a house or sideways. It's just sort of an interesting thing that if you didn't know the story, you could walk right by it without noticing. I talk about different theaters that she went to learn how to. She learned to read reading silent movie captions, which is so cool. And that theater's still there. So places like that that were part of her life and illustrate what Portland was like in the 20s, that's a big part of it. And then beyond Portland, there's a chapter that's kind of a Beverly Cleary treasure hunt, where you different places in Oregon that she and her family went when she was here in the 1920s and 30s, and talk about kind of their historic context.
So what made you, you kind of talked about this, but what made you decide to write about Portland of Ms. Cleary's childhood and its transformation to the city we know today?
Well, as with my other books, I'm really fascinated by the stories of a place, the backstories of how they got to the point where we see them today and we inhabit them. And every neighborhood in Portland has kind of this arc of, you know, first everything was rural, forest, meadow, and then it was logged, and then it was farmed. Then it was developed. East Side neighborhoods, like where Beverly grew up, didn't get developed until bridges crossed the Willamette River beginning in the late 1880s. And they couldn't be developed until streetcars could extend out to them because, like I said, nobody had cars. People didn't have horses in town either. That's kind of a, people think those horse rings were for individual horses. Well, they weren't. So anyway, so I like to talk about how neighborhoods evolved and then also the geology of our city. And so all of this kind of weaves together the stories of the place. And with Beverly's life, you know, it's just a really rich paint pot of information that I could use to paint a really great picture of what one young girl's Portland looked like, partly because Beverly in her two autobiographies was extremely detailed in what life was like for her. And, you know, when you think about most histories of place or just of events, they're written by men. And so it's really neat to get a history of life in Portland from the point of view of a young woman. And so I think my book kind of takes you on that history as you see it today and experience it today, but also seeing these layers that came before.
And she had a really interesting childhood, and she has two biographies out, one, A Girl from Yamhill, and then I can't remember.
My Own Two Feet.
My Own Two Feet was really interesting about her going to college and becoming a children's librarian and things like that. So she is definitely special to Portland, and she just celebrated her 100th birthday.
Yes, and she's living in Carmel, California. She left Portland when she went to college in Southern California, and then she went to Berkeley, got her graduate degree up in Seattle, but then she never really came back here to live. And she met her husband in California, and they settled there in Berkeley and then eventually Carmel.
There are so many interesting tidbits throughout the book. One that really stood out to me was the history of Portland's addresses and the problems that popped up as the city expanded. It kind of sounded like a mess. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's really fascinating how
you know, the city, we did, you know how we have, we're really famous now for our land use planning laws, but back then there were no such laws. So if you were a developer and you bought, you know, half acre plot of land, you would put your houses in, you would lay out the streets, you could call them whatever you want. And the street that ended right before your plot might have one name, but you might decide to change the name of the street. And so it was a mishmash. There were lots of first avenues, like seven, I think there were seven first avenues in Portland at the time. And so the city had worked for decades trying to straighten out the mess, and it wasn't until the 30s that they actually implemented a pretty unified plan that was based on kind of the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania plan. And they borrowed some things from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, too. And they had these little address tiles printed up in California, the same tile company that makes the tiles for Stanford University's roofs. They stopped manufacturing roof tiles for Stanford for a while, and they manufactured these little white and black glazed ceramic address tiles that you see in Portland. And it was fortunately timed in that it was the Great Depression. And the Depression was this time, of course, when so many people were out of work in the city, or the country was investing in infrastructure back then as a way just to put men to work, primarily men. And so one of the projects that lasted a couple years here in Portland was for men to walk around block by block and install these new address numbers on houses. So while Beverly was here, her address changed. She was living on Northeast 37th. It was called East 37th Street North when she was living there. Now it's Northeast 37th Avenue. So she would have had to learn a new address for herself.
Another thing, you mentioned that Portland grocer Fred Meyer's store was one of the first one-stop shopping stores in the nation, a concept later used by Sam Walton of Walmart fame. And I'm not from here, so I had no idea, and I don't know if other people knew about that or not. Can you talk about any other facts that came up during your research that listeners may find surprising?
About Fred Meyer or just...
Or just about anything.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Let's see. Manuka in the Columbia River Gorge. I know when you're driving out looking at the waterfalls, you see this sign that looks kind of mysterious, Manuka. It used to be the estate of our governor, Julius Meyer. And when he died in the 30s, and then his family donated it, and now, they sold it to the Presbyterian Church, and now it's a private retreat place, so you can't go there, except they have one room that if you want to go on a private retreat, you can go for a very nominal fee and inhabit this cliff top of the gorge for a night. So that's a pretty, pretty cool place, and they're just lovely folks there. So let's see, a few other things. Beverly named her doll Fordson Lafayette after the town Lafayette, where one of her ancestors settled. Oh, and one fact I just loved was that, you know, Portland, you used to be able to take a train from Portland to Corvallis or Portland to Salem, and they called them interurban lines. And so her mom, when she was 8.5 months pregnant with Beverly, decided, you know, the time was getting close. So she hopped on a train in Yamhill, which is still, you know, quite rural. And that back then was very rural. But the train stopped there. And she took the train a couple stops to McMinnville, got off, walked to the hospital, and helped out cleaning floors and folding sheets and washing windows for a week while she waited for the baby to arrive. And then Beverly was born. And so and that site today is a Walgreens. So the hospital's gone. But just these great stories of what life was like when Beverly was a small girl in Oregon. And the vestiges you can still see from that era. It's pretty fascinating.
One thing that kind of stood out to me is it seems like you talk about her father being unemployed and they didn't have a lot of money at certain times during her life. But there are certain things that kind of struck me as what I would think of as not for a family that didn't have much money. She went to the orthodontist for 6 years.
Yes. Well, that was because they had sold their farm in Yamhill. They, when they moved here in 1922, it was because he wasn't able to make a living as a farmer. Mm-hmm. A lot of farmers were having that problem. The commodity prices were not supported, so they just couldn't harvest and sell for what it cost them to produce. So he reluctantly came to Portland. And then after 5 years, they made a decision to sell their farm. And so it was, it was very sad for them. And he had been suffering from depression because the only jobs he was able to get in Portland as a man with only a 10th grade education was standing in a bank vault all day. And as a man, you know, of the soil all his life, that was a horrible transition for him. So they eventually sold the farm. And with that money, they bought a Model A car, and they were able to send Beverly to the orthodontist. Mm. So eventually, a few years later, they had to sell the car, though. So and they were able to buy a house. So they were better off than a lot of people, but they, like, she remembers being asked to be a bridesmaid for a friend's wedding in the early 30s when she was about 20. And it was, she didn't know whether she could accept because it was such a hardship to actually afford the gowns. So she and the other bridesmaids who were all in the same boat made their own gowns. And she said that the bride, who was from a wealthy family, had this beautiful couture gown. And she said, we all kind of look like, you know, the happy hands at home type gowns. So her life wasn't horrible, but she had no luxuries. Oh, and one other thing about that orthodontist, that I tell a little story in the book about, she was downtown in the Selling Building, so she would take the streetcar down there, and the Selling Building is still there at, I think it's 6th and Southwest Alder, or maybe 7th. And Ben Selling was this really amazing Portland character who built the building. He was a philanthropist. He was a Jew who had moved here early on and prospered quite well, I think in retail. But then in the 1890s, all of these Eastern European Jews were forced to leave because of pogroms and persecution, and they were flooding the United States. We had an open immigration policy back then, and Jews were long used to persecution, and they were afraid that if too many Jews moved to America, there would be a backlash. So there was this program implemented to kind of have sponsors in each town all over the country, and Ben Selling was a sponsor here in Portland. So he kind of, you know, was the welcoming host that all these poor immigrants who were fleeing persecution would come to Portland, get this welcome, and he would help them find housing and jobs, and he was much beloved in the country. So it was his building that she had her orthodontist in, and the building is still there, and there's businesses that you can patronize still in it.
So this book is filled with both photographs and drawings. Where did this come from?
Well, the photos I took, and then the historic photos I mostly got from the archives, the Portland Archives, which are a wonderful resource. I recommend people going down there and investigating your neighborhood. You can learn a lot. There's a couple that I got from the Lake Oswego Public Library, too. And the drawings were by the publishers. I don't know, graphic design person.
Oh, okay.
Microcosm Publishing is a publisher. And about the drawings, they had to be careful because all the drawings in the Beverly Cleary books are copyrighted, of course. And so the initial drawings very closely resembled the Lewis Darling drawings. He was the first illustrator of Beverly's books. And so it was deemed that they were a little too close in style. So they kind of changed the style to not look quite so much like the originals.
Do you want to talk about some of the walking tours that are actually in the... or the walking tour that's actually in the book. So for Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday, they had a Walking with Ramona tour that I assume that was your tour. And they had
I think they
the
had
library.
To shorten it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is kind of an expanded version of that tour that was available at the Multnomah County Libraries during that time. Can you talk about any certain stops during the tour that might be of particular interest?
Yeah.
What it's...
Yeah. So the tour starts and ends the loop. I always do loops on all my walking tours. Anyway, it starts at the Beverly Cleary Sculpture Garden in Grant Park. And it visits two of her schools that she attended when she was in Portland. One of them is further out in Northeast Portland, and she only went there for a year. So it goes to Fernwood, which is now Beverly Cleary campus at Fernwood. And it also goes to Grant High School. It goes to the Fleur-de-Lis Bakery, which is in the old library building, the Hollywood Library, that I think they moved in 2000 when they built their current new location. But when Beverly was a girl, that particular building was an older brick structure that was torn down in the 50s. And so, but you can still go to the same place. And it's right down the street where she lived. Hancock Street is where she lived for years. So you're walking along Hancock, and that's a street that she had kind of a wonderful childhood on. She was an only child, and the street, she said, was filled with children who kind of move like flocks of birds through the neighborhood. And she loved, you know, just the creativity and the fun of being with all these kids, especially because her own household was kind of grim. She said it was a place where laughter was never heard, for example. Mm-hmm. So the kids on Hancock Street are the ones that were the inspiration for the kids in her books. And she called it a click-a-tat street because she liked the sound of that better. So the tour takes you down Hancock to the library site where she spent so much time. And that's where she decided to become a librarian based on her enjoyment of that. It goes to the Hollywood Theater where Beverly would go for 10 cents a movie to watch first silent movies and then talkies. She was a young teen when talkies were invented and became popular. And some other places in Hollywood that she would have walked by. And one in particular I'm fascinated by. It's this beautiful apartment building of the sort that nowadays we would all love to live in, you know, with the wood floors and the high ceilings and the stucco and everything. And her mother did not let her go into that building or any apartment building because she said the people who lived in apartments weren't substantial sorts of people, which I think is kind of probably a rural prejudice against urban life. You know, you're just not sure who might be in that mysterious building with all the all the people. So anyway, and then I think it's super ironic now in Hollywood, in the neighborhood, there's an apartment building named the Beverly after Beverly Cleary. So I don't know what her mother would think of that, but probably not much. And the walk, then it takes you to the last house she lived in on 37th Avenue before she went off to college, and then takes you up to Alameda Ridge. The house on 37th, her mom really loved because it's kind of on the lee side of Alameda Ridge, so it doesn't get the gorge winds, the east winds that are so cold in the winter. And her mom felt like that was really important because they'd spent one winter out on Northeast 77th, and it was really exposed to the gorge winds, and they could never keep the house warm enough. So this little house is kind of in this cozy little nook at the base of Alameda Ridge, and the walk takes you up to the top of the ridge via one of the city staircases, which I love to highlight. And then you come down and walk through Grant Park on the way back. It's really scenic. The houses in Hollywood are just gorgeous.
They definitely are. And there's Klickitat Street is pretty, some amazing houses up there.
Yeah, right. I mean, just as soon as you start to get a little elevation just beyond Beverly's house, the house styles change and they get more grand and the views get grander and everything is quite different. So she would have seen that too.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author Laura Foster about her new book, Walking with Ramona, Exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland. So I'm wondering, how did you get into writing local guidebooks?
Well, I had moved here in 1989, in my 20s, and I lived in Hollywood, just a few blocks from where Beverly lived, and wanted to explore. I've always been a person that will just start walking or riding my bike and then get myself lost and get a map out and figure out how to get back. And I did that in Portland, and there weren't any guidebooks that I could find that were not hiking guidebooks. Oh, there was, I didn't even know if there was a Forest Park guidebook back then. And so about 10 years later, after I'd been working in the publishing industry as a book editor for Beyond Words Publishing out in Hillsboro, I had seen a lot of people propose books, and it kind of demystified the process, like, well, if they can do it, I can do it. So I had this book idea of kind of celebrating how fascinating Portland's neighborhoods are. And meanwhile, I had married a man who's a local guy who is a geologist and geotechnical engineer. So he used to take me on these hidden pathways from his childhood up in the West Hills and just show me places that I would have never probably found on my own, and then tell me the geology and kind of what had gone on and where landslides had happened. And I thought, these are great stories. I need to weave them together into a book. So that was my first book, Portland Hill Walks. And this was back when Portland was really not a hip place. So I remember sending it to about 7 publishers. And a couple on the East Coast said, you know, Portland, Oregon, you know, it's not like it's New York City. I don't think anybody would be interested in walking in Portland, Oregon. So I love that now, because now we are the darling of like the New York Times and all the newspapers back East. But luckily, Timber Press, who's a local publisher, or was then, they've since been bought out by Workman Publishing in New York. They saw the book and said, yeah, this sounds great. So they published it, and it's done well for them.
Great. Well, I think you kind of touched on something. So when we're taking these walks, we're absolutely seeing things that we never would have seen otherwise, because we just wouldn't have found them, or we'd see a building but not really pay attention to it, or not realize the historical significance. So I really encourage people to try out these walks, because you definitely see a side of the city that you wouldn't normally notice.
Yeah, thank you. And the other thing is, I really like to get people off the beaten track. So if you're exploring a neighborhood like Kearns or Buckman, I'm not going to take you down the main streets. You're not going to go be walking on Sandy Boulevard or Stark or Belmont. You're going to be kind of more on these little side streets where it's kind of annoying to have to drive your car. And so the streets have these beautiful kind of back in time qualities. And then the architecture is amazing in Portland, especially the last 20 years. Portland has just been kind of reappreciating its old neighborhoods, and they're just, it's just a joy to see what people do to their homes.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned architecture, because that's my next question. You reference a lot of architectural styles in your books. For example, we spent a lot of time looking at the unique Art Deco Salvation Army building in one of the Portland City Walks, and it's something that we probably wouldn't have paid attention to otherwise. What is it about architecture that interests you?
Well, I think it's just the creativity on display. You know, when I was younger, I didn't care about things like that. And now when I take a walk, I'm always interested in the architectural styles. And I know not everybody is, so I try not to go real heavy on that. But if you're interested, it's so fun to have some names for styles, like, oh, that's Art Deco, or that's Art Moderne, and that's a Craftsman, and things like that, to just know a little bit of that language, because this is where we live. And so if you know those kind of facts, it just makes it feel like, well, this is my place, and I know what these, you know, I know the names of these people. It's almost like knowing your neighbor's names. Same with street trees. I'm a big proponent of learning about street trees. I think every Oregonian should know about five basic plants like Douglas fir and Oregon grape and things like that, Western red cedar. And the Native Americans who lived here before us, well, they really used these plants. They were integral parts of their lives. So it's, I think if you live here and this is where, you know, you're calling this place home, you should know some of these things. So I try to kind of weave all that into the walks too.
I think you do a good job too, and especially since Portland is so diverse in its neighborhoods and architectural styles, and there's a lot of different plants that I haven't seen. I'm from the Midwest, so I hadn't seen before, and so there's all these flowering trees and bushes that I go, wow, these are amazing. What kinds of things are these? And that's some of the things that we're learning from your book. So I'm glad you mentioned the plants and some of those things that are unique to Portland, or at least unique to this part of the country.
Yeah, I agree. And they this time of year, the springtime, the East Side neighborhoods, especially the older ones, are just like a bower of color. They're so bright. People have, you know, and a lot of the plants that are colorful aren't native plants. People have brought them in, but it's just a pleasure to walk through there and see, you know, a sidewalk that's pink with petals, you know, and things like that. I have a picture on my Facebook page right now of this cat sitting on this pink sidewalk, just looking so proud of himself. It's fun.
So I've done a few of the tours from your book, Portland City Walks, and I was struck by how incredibly detailed the tours are, both historically and with clear walking directions. And I like how you mention how to get there, where to park, but also how to take public transportation, and that's really helpful. How do you research for these books?
You know, the Hill Walks book is in the hills. The City Walks books are flatter neighborhoods like Laurelhurst and Irvington. And I will start off with different data points that I want to make sure I include just based on my own personal knowledge of exploring the city, like maybe, you know, a fabulous mansion or a church or a heritage tree or a street that I have found to be especially beautiful because maybe it's, you know, got an elm column along the sidewalk that's, you know, spectacular. And then places that are of historic interest, of course, or geologic interest, or a hidden path. And so I have all these things that count, you know, they're data points. And then I come up with a route on paper, looking at topographic maps, especially for the Hill Walks book. And then once I get on the ground, I generally adapt it because I'll see like a street nearby that I hadn't considered, but it's just got something like maybe a front yard is all full of rock cairns or something like that, that I feel like, oh, people got to see this. And so I'll adapt it from that perspective. And then I used to be a technical writer back in my 20s. And so I'm pretty detailed, and I think there's nothing worse than a set of directions that are wrong. And so I have walked the routes many, many, many times to make sure that, you know, because it's really easy to skip a step, you know, when you're mm-hmm. giving directions, and to make sure that they are explicit and clear without, I hope, being too pedantic.
I think you do a good job of that, and especially as someone who is directionally impaired, it's very important, and I appreciate that you give very clear directions, but also things so detailed as this: you'll go down 20 stairs, and then you'll end up in this place. So that's really helpful.
Oh, that's funny. I have people email me who count stairs too, and when my stairs book, I did the stairs. Oh, probably each staircase at least five times up and down, because I would often get a different number every time I do it. So I have to keep doing it till I get the same number more than twice. And so, yeah, because people love to correct you. So, and I think that's sometimes I actually plant a few little errors like that in there just to see if anybody catches like the number of steps. It's like, just to, you know, see if they're listening or watching.
Well, I was going to ask you that. I don't have any personally, but I'm curious, have you gotten many complaints about your walking tours?
You know, I haven't. I've been really lucky. One street I was getting complaints on, and I got a really nasty email. This was maybe 10 years ago, from a woman who was very angry. And it's up in the West Hills in Portland Heights, and there's a street called Corona. And when I had written my directions, the street sign was missing. And so it's this little warren of twisty streets up there. And I didn't know that it was called Corona for some reason. I missed it. And so I just wrote it and later found out that the street sign Corona keeps getting stolen because it's the name of a beer.
Oh.
And so now the sign was back and she was upset that I hadn't mentioned that turn onto Corona. And it was just it was kind of nitpicky, but it was also, it was good for me to be corrected. But it makes me glad people are paying attention and buying the book.
That's true. Approximately how long does it take you to come up with a walking tour and then, you know, plot it out, as you said, with the data points and connect everything and then put it into a loop and kind of do that whole process that you do to come up with one walking tour? And most of the books have 20 to 25 tours within them.
Well, that's a good question. It takes a lot longer than you would think because it's not just a matter of coming up with the route and printing out the directions, the turn-by-turn directions. It's kind of like writing a tweet, you know, that you have to have a whole bunch of information and then you have to condense it to a really tight format because I don't have a lot of room. You know, in some of my books, I have, I think the walks are 4,000 words. And so if I have a 7-mile walk, a lot of that gets consumed with the turn-by-turn directions. But then there's all these other layers I want to weave in. So there's a lot of learning that goes on and research. And then winnowing it down. So I don't know. It takes a lot longer. And if I were to charge, you know, by the hour, I would never be able to sell these walks. You know, people sometimes ask me to create a walk for them. And I do a lot of stuff for civic purposes, but it's not really a way to make money.
It's a labor of love.
Yeah.
So let's say I've got a copy of the book and I'm ready to tackle my first tour. What's the best way to experience one of your tours? And do you have any tips?
Yes, always bring money and don't worry about bringing water and, you know, walking poles, because most of my walks are on city streets. Although Portland Hill Walks, it goes into the parklands a lot, especially Forest Park. I love to weave in kind of urban and natural areas. But I'm a big believer that if you're off exploring anywhere, whether it's your own hometown, neighborhoods, or a city, or you should always spend money and support the local businesses because you're enjoying the whole vibe that the neighborhood has created for you as a visitor. And the best way to give back is to, you know, stop and have lunch or, you know, browse in a bookstore and pick up a book, that kind of thing. And just be prepared to not hurry through it. A lot of people tell me that they read my directions and they'll photocopy the book, or nowadays you can just take photos on your phone and carry that with you because the books are kind of heavy. But if you read the chapter ahead of time, you don't have to refer to it so closely. You kind of go, oh yeah, I remember when she talked about that, and it's a little more spontaneous feeling. And I also encourage people, you know, of course, get off the route. If something, you know, at every intersection, I always stop and look and like, okay, what is the best way to go from here? Like, what looks most intriguing? So, you know, you might find a street that is just irresistibly fascinating and you have to deviate from the route, and I say you should.
And when we're walking around, I'm carrying the book and reading out of it as we go, and I had people stop and ask me, like, what are you doing? Are you learning about the city? And so I refer them to it.
Thank you.
So as someone who's clearly been all over the city to the point of counting the number of steps or whatnot, what's your favorite part of the city? Do you have one?
You know, I don't have one because I love Portland so much. I mean, my husband would get super frustrated with me. I'd come home after researching, you know, a neighborhood like Selwood or Eastmoreland or the Rocky Butte area, and I'd be like, we got to move. I love it. It's so cool. There's all this. And then I'd list out all these wonderful things like great coffee houses or there's a library. So I do love everything about the city. But I say, you know, this time of year, definitely head to the old neighborhoods because of the color. And I would say that's more on the east side. Urban walks in the winter are just a really great way to get outdoors because even if you get soaked in a rainstorm, you're not very far from, you know, your home or a bus stop or a coffee house. And so I think urban walking is really great for the months where Portland's kind of rainy. And contrary to what everybody says, I carry an umbrella because I hate wearing swishy fabric like Gore-Tex that makes noise when I walk because I want to be able to hear my surroundings. So I just wear wool and carry an umbrella, and it's just like it's the most wonderful thing to do. So, and another good thing, the West Hills are good in the winter because you're going to be climbing hills and that'll warm you up.
Good tip.
Yeah.
So we're fairly new to Portland, and one of the first things we did was go to the library and get a library card. And we checked out books about the area, including some walking tour books, and we were really lucky that such a thing existed. Let's say, hypothetically, that you just moved to a new city that doesn't have the work already done for you. How would you go about learning your new home?
Well, I start with the topographic features. Like if it had a river, I would explore the river looking for paths. If it has hills, I get out topographic maps and I look for really steep changes in elevation. And then I go looking for pathways that people have created, because often there'll be a dead end at one level of the elevation and then there'll be a street continuing at another. And then there's usually a path or staircase that isn't going to show up on a lot of maps. Nowadays, when I first started writing, I used AAA maps, and they didn't show stairs or anything like that. Nowadays, when you pull up Google Maps, you can a lot of that stuff is on there. But it was kind of fun to not know what I'd find, you know, to just go out there and have some idea of where I wanted to explore. So I think it's good to have like a couple of fulcrums, like maybe you want to explore along a river one day, or you want to, you see a park in the distance. Like I'm always looking for tall trees in the distance because that usually means there's a city park nearby. So, you know, just kind of exploring a radius around a park. And just by doing that, you know, it's just so fascinating what you find. I think one thing I like about urban walking more than walking in natural areas is that human creativity is on display everywhere, and people do the most wonderful things with their homes and their yards. So it's just fun, you know, it's just a little more fun than, you know, walking in the woods.
So I'm sure at this point we've got some listeners ready to get out and explore. Where can people find your books?
They are available at all local booksellers. All the great independents that we have here in Portland carry my books, and they've been really supportive of them. And I understand that KBOO has a link on its homepage for Powell's. And if you want to buy the book through Powell's, you'll get KBOO will get 7.5% of the sale price. So that's a really nice option if you want to support KBOO and get a book.
Excellent. So you have a website at lauraofoster.com. Are there any other ways people can find out about your work?
Yeah, generally, people will ask me. I used to lead walking tours more regularly. I did a lot of work for Metro, the regional government, and I don't anymore. But I lead occasional tours, like for the city of Portland. I've got two this summer that are free. And the city has this program called Tento Express, really great series of walks. If you're new to Portland, you'll be taken to all these cool areas. And sometimes there's interpretation, and other times you just walk and visit with the folks with you. But on my Facebook, I recommend people become a Facebook follower or a friend of mine, Laura O. Foster, on Facebook. I don't post about my pets or kids or what I cook for dinner. I just post about things that I think people will be interested in. So you won't have to put up with my personal life.
So what's your next project?
I can't say.
Oh.
Right. But right now, one of my books, Columbia Gorge Getaways, is at the printer in Illinois, and I'll get it in about 2 weeks. And then I'm going to spend the summer promoting that and hopefully selling all the copies that I will be soon sitting in my front porch. And then I've got another regional guidebook plan, not a Portland one, but I'd rather keep it under my vest for now.
Okay. I'm just going to give you a suggestion.
Oh, yes.
So you have Walking with Ramona. I'm hoping that the next thing you'll do is Walking with Matt Groening.
Oh, you know, that is so funny. I think I should do that. My husband went to college or high school with him, and grade school too. So they're not friends right now, dang it. But I think that would be fun.
All right. I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your books?
I think if you're a newcomer to Portland, it's a great way to become a Portlander, to really feel like you understand all the different neighborhoods of the city. You don't have to do all the walks, but if you do want a couple in southeast, northeast, all the different quadrants, you're going to really understand the city in a way that even longtime Portlanders who only stay in their own quadrant, which a lot of us do, wouldn't know. So it kind of makes you feel like you own this place, you know, and I think when you are like that, then you become a better citizen because you care more about it. So I would really suggest, you know, using the books, and you can get them at the library. You don't have to buy them, but they're just a good tool for becoming a Portlander.
Great. Laura Foster, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Oh, thanks, Bethany. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.